Sunday, June 10th, 2018. That was the fourth anniversary of WWGH Radio taking the airwaves. It's been a great 4 years. Hello again, this is Adam Lipp, one of the managers here, webmaster, show host, and I do multiple things here at the old radio station. In fact, one of the things that I do here at the station, which I enjoy most of all, is listening to Scott Spears, our program director. I call him the interviewer to the stars. And if you listen to Scott's show, you know what I mean. This gentleman has talked to everybody from Bob Barker to Ed Asner to Monty Hall to Pat Carroll to Dick Gregory. Pretty much a who's who of famous, important, interesting, and controversial people that would encompass whom Scott speaks with on his radio program, which is called Now. It's not on now, but I can give you something at least as good. Some highlights of the most memorable interviews that Scott has given in the last 4 years. Let's start out with one that I think is one of the best from 2017, and that would be Bernie Coppell, who played Dr. Adam Bricker on The Love Boat.
Maybe this will take you back a little bit.
It floats back to you. Love boat. Soon we'll be making another run. The love boat promises something for everyone. Set a course for adventure, your mind on a new road. Won't hurt anymore. It's an open smile on a friendly shore. It's love. Welcome aboard. It's love.
Our guest today is a legendary actor, Doc from The Love Boat, Bernie Coppell. Bernie, how are you?
I'm a lot better hearing Jack Jones sing our iconic song from Love Boat. I tell you, I just got off a cruise, and then I came back to I was in Corfu, Greece. I flew to Berlin. I flew to Munich. I flew from Munich all the way to San Francisco to do another in-house commercial for Princess. Princess is, it just makes me happy, just sends warm feelings through my body. We started back in 76, and we're going stronger than ever before, and I'm delighted to hear Jack Jones and just to think about Princess.
41 years ago, hard to believe,
yeah,
that started. How did it all come about for you?
Well, it's an odd thing. Dickie Van Patten, my dear friend who recently passed away, was the doctor on the original Love Boat, and at the same time he was, excuse me, he was under contract to ABC. They pulled him out just when we were doing our second pilot to do Eight Is Enough. That opened it up for somebody, and I didn't get pulled in right away. I had to test, and Ted Lange, my dear friend who was our bartender, said, "Nyah, nyah, 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 nyah." I didn't have to test, referring to himself. He did not test, and he got the part. I had to test, and I tested, and I guess my test worked out very nicely because I got the part of Doc Bricker, and that was the beginning. But you have no idea in the beginning how the thing is going to go, how the American public will like it or not like it. So there we were doing our second pilot, and we got the crappiest reviews you could not hope for. They said, it's going to sink like the Titanic. And they said, who would ever want to watch that inane show? Well, who wanted to watch it was the American public. And we went on for 10 years, and then we did 3 2-hour specials, and it's just changed the cruise industry. It showed the public that how easy it is, how inexpensive it is relatively to take a cruise. And we created a billion dollar, that's with a B, billion-dollar industry for the cruise industry. So we're delighted about that.
It's interesting you talk about the reviews, because the lead on Love Boat was Gavin McLeod, and he had come off Mary Tyler Moore, and he talks about how his agent said, if you take this, you will ruin your career. This is an awful show. Critics, agents certainly didn't, and he took it, and thank goodness. But what was it about The Love Boat that you think made agents and critics so angry?
What was it about Love Boat the agents don't have any artistic judgment. They just are in it for the money. It doesn't matter what they say. If they can negotiate well for you, then that's a plus. But they don't really have any artistic judgment. So actors should never be deceived and think that they do. What it was having people just get on a beautiful, clean ship and be able to just cruise, just go away from their daily cares, their daily worries. For women, you don't have to make beds, you don't have to do any cooking. Everything is done for you. Now, more than ever, by the way, our original ship, the Pacific Princess, was 553 feet. At that time, I thought, wow, this is so beautiful, because I'd come out of the Navy 20 years before, and I was on a warship. I was on the USS Iowa. All of a sudden, you come into the San Pedro Harbor, and you see this stunning, clean, white ship, not a speck of rust on it, that is going to take you on this fantasy trip. And it was just amazing, especially to me, because I was the only one who had been in the Navy. So as time went on and people really got tuned in to how much fun, how easy, how carefree cruises were, it built up a business. It built up more clientele. The last ship I was on, the Regal Princess. The original ship was 553 feet. This ship, as stunning as it is, was 1,082 feet. And I have gone on my beautiful Pacific Princess, Island Princess, Dawn Princess, which we inaugurated, all over the world. So it's been just this dream of a job, and I and my family are very, very grateful to have this, because back in my early days, you know, working with Jack Benny, working with Doris Day, doing Bewitched with the beautiful Elizabeth Montgomery, you do your 3 days, and then you're out, and you're in Hollywood. You do your 4 days, you do your 2 days, you're in Hollywood. But here, on the ships, the world comes to you. This sounds like a commercial for Princess, which is not. It's just talking about my experience. So it's just this amazing thing. We started going to Mexico again and again and again and again. Then somebody whispered in Aaron Spelling's ear, we're a hit. We can go anywhere. We can go other places. Then we went to the Caribbean. Then we went to the Mediterranean. Then we went to Scandinavia, the Near East, the Far East, all over the world. And once we got going, we were seen in 98 countries.
Florence Johnston, the delightfully sassy maid on The Jeffersons, played expertly by Marla Gibbs. She's not just a talented actress, she is quite a singer. She has graced our airwaves several times. Interesting guest, very smart lady, and sometimes a little surprising what she has to say. But that's all part of the fun of live radio. She also starred as Mary Jenkins in 227. And by the way, her co-star was Hal Williams, who was a native of Columbus, Ohio. Local connection there. Here's an excerpt of one of Scott's interviews with Marla Gibbs.
It's important to me to make it as real as possible. And the only thing you can do is what you know or what you feel.
When you get a script and it call, let's go back to, say, Mary Jenkins from 227. And by the way, I am so glad to see that 227 is back kind of heavy in reruns all of a sudden. I love
oh,
that
thank
show.
You.
I love thank 227. You. And to me, and this will be sacrilege to a lot of people, I actually like 227 better than the Jeffersons. I love that cast.
Well, I've heard that too. I've heard that from several people.
It's
different.
It is different. It's
Mary is different from Florence. People were always saying, why don't they let you have a man? You ought to have a man. So when I did 227, I realized I had to have a man. So I wouldn't do the show without having a man. Because that's a whole new spectrum. Florence was single. She hadn't been married. So it was a whole different dynamic. And I think a lot of people really connected with 227, especially husbands and wives, because when we argue, they get a chance to take a side. The wife will say, see what I'm telling you. If they're arguing, she'll say, see, that's what I'm talking about. What she said, that's right. And he'll do the same thing when Lester wins the argument.
Well, I have to say this, Marla, and I credit you with this, and maybe this is the secret of 227, and I'm so glad they're rerunning it. I actually have it on my TiVo to tape 227, and I've seen some of these episodes a few times, but I love them.
Thank you.
That series is timeless. It took place in the 1980s, but you can play it today, and it's today. It's not dated.
Right. Everything we did is what people do, so it doesn't really change. Our experiences are pretty much the same because we are all one, whether we believe it or not, we are one.
Is Marla Gibbs more like Florence Johnston or Mary Jenkins?
I think she's a little of both.
When you know, because I was
Gemini, and they accuse us of being twins. So I guess one twin is Mary and one twin is Florence.
Well, I say this to people as well who don't know the history of television. The Jeffersons ran 11 years, and I was never sure how this happened, ran 11 years on CBS and ended in the spring of 1985. 227 went on NBC in the fall of 1985. How did that work, Marla?
Well, when we sold the show to NBC, we sold it as a second to the Jeffersons. So we didn't know the Jeffersons was going off. In 1985, we actually thought we had another season. And they took it off without explanation. And they never told the public that it was going off, so we never had a final show, and we never had a reunion. So we already had 227 in place because we had done the pilot to hold for when the Jeffersons went off, so we had it, so we just went on and put it on.
Were you shocked at all that you walked out of a series that was popular for 11 years and immediately within 3 months in a series that was in the top 10?
No, because actually I'm the one that sold the show to NBC along with Norman Lear. And so we were expecting the show to go. We just didn't expect it to go like that.
You know, the 227 program, I felt could have gone longer. What happened in the... Well, you know, Marla, I'll just ask you, because I consider you a friend. There was so much in the tabloids at that time about you and Jack A., and I know that's water under the bridge now, but what happened there?
Actually, a lot of that was contrived. I don't know, but I won't say by who, because I don't know. But actually, Jack A. and I didn't have a problem. I mean, she was unhappy about some things because she wanted to be the star of her own show. And she really and she did get a chance to do that, although they only gave her one. But you know how they like to hype things up? Out of mercy, you sell a lot of shows. And a lot of controversy is built around shows that don't really happen. They make up a lot of stuff.
Well, just for his...
Things that, for example, they said that it was out that I never was happy about Jack A. getting her show or getting me any. And actually, I had talked to production, and we arranged to have a big floral arrangement for her on the set. Then I found out she was leaving early, so I went to them and I said, she's not going to see the flowers. But then they told me the florist caught her at the car before she left and gave her the flowers. So the next day I said, did you get your flowers? And she said, yes. That turned out, that never happened according to the way it was told.
Well,
and then there was a party for her for the Emmys. And we, none of us were invited. We never knew where the party was. Everybody kept saying, do you know where the party is? We said, no. So we didn't find out where the party was, so we didn't show up. But that wasn't because we didn't want to. It's because we did not know where the party was. Since then, Jackie and I have worked 3 or 4 times. She's apologized 3 or 4 times.
I guess since I'm producing and voicing this show, it's okay to be slightly biased, but I don't think many people would disagree that one of the greatest actors of sitcom and dramatic TV is Ed Asner. Ed has spoken with Scott several times. Late in 2017, they discussed not only his career as an actor, but his new book.
And I want to make sure again, The Grouchy Historian, A Holiday Gift. You will not be able to put it down. Ed Asner and Ed Weinberger. You know, Mr. Asner, most people now, I think, obviously assume and know that you are of the left. When did you make that choice? Did you grow up in a Democratic left liberal household?
Not really. My father was a businessman. Tentative to vote Republican, as I recall. I think he even voted against Roosevelt. My mother, thankfully, was there to cancel out his vote. My brothers were not... We were all being Jews. We had to be of a liberal bent for survival, or at least at the prospect of survival. But there was no campaign to fund the Civil Liberties Union. Both my sisters were social workers, and I think I got a lot of my social and liberal philosophy from them. But my folks were average centrists, but they were fair. They were exceedingly fair. And, I don't think I could have had a better pair to draw to. My brothers were more, businessmen, and yet very bright at the same time. So I learned from both sides. Finally ending up at the university. And bear in mind, we came from Kansas, which in those days had a good, strong, clean, conservative aspect. But we came from Kansas City, Kansas, which bordered on the slave state of Missouri, and we were offset by their presence. We had segregated schools, which we certainly did not enjoy, and should have had what most of Kansas had, which was open schooling.
I am going to grab the table here before I ask this next question. What do you make of President Trump?
What did I make?
What do you make of him? What do you think about his presidency?
Well, I think he's a big, clumsy guy who stumbles clumsily through his thoughts and speeches, and clumsiness is a part of his being. Why we are busy purging people right and left for sexual embracing, as it tends to be referred to, and why his own testimony on Access Hollywood is not being held against him or count against him in his being president, amazes me. We won a big victory in Alabama the other day. Not we, but I congratulate the people of Alabama for their integrity in getting rid of Roy Moore, who has yet to concede, I believe, but and who was endorsed by President Trump. But there has to be a bigger outcry as to his own testimony, which he has tried to deny on that show, Access Hollywood. He's a brash bully, is I guess the easiest way I can describe him.
There is a group in this country, political scholars at universities, who don't seem to think he's going to make his full term, that he'll either resign or be impeached. Do you foresee that?
Well, if Robert Mueller comes through with sufficient evidence to force him to resign, I think this country has a large, angry right wing. And that right wing will raise so much hell at cashiering Donald Trump, I fear for the results. So I don't think anybody's going to rush into getting rid of him, even though I think the Republicans would love to. Because I think he makes Republican votes for those people who like the outspokenness. He's a catalyst for the libertarian type attitude. But when you deal with the country as a whole, I think he's going to... I mean, he lost by almost 3 million votes popularly. And I think that's the one thing I would want to speak out against constantly, that someone who had almost 3 million votes more than he did lost because of the Electoral College. And I think that Electoral College is a danger because it was engineered back in the old days when that Second Amendment was drawn up, same type of thing, and it was designed to give the smaller states power, and it's given them such power that they override the larger states, and I don't like the results.
We are a fairly young country, 250 years old. When do you think, what was the best time? We had the Civil War, we had the beginning, we have now. Was the 20th century the best, in your opinion?
Well, World War II, this country was singularly united and forward and rich and built up Europe and policed Japan properly. I don't think we've ever been stronger. But since that time, we've been bleeding to death.
This is Adam Lepp with WWGH Radio, presenting highlights of the Scott Spears radio program, celebrity interviews, and other stuff. Anyway, Madeleine Albright, the first female Secretary of State, back just before the 2016 election. She talked to Scott about what might happen if there is a President Trump.
I have heard many times when we open up the phone lines here at the station, people say, if Donald Trump does get in, what kind of damage could he do? He's got to deal with Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court. From somebody who's been there and dealing with foreign countries, if he's in there, what could there be a bad future?
I'm concerned about that. I have said that if he gets elected, it is a danger to the United States. The truth is, in many ways, just the kinds of things that he's saying during the campaign is a danger to the United States. The United States, for our national interests and our the safety of our citizens, does have to be involved with other countries, needs to be respected by other countries, needs to respect other countries. And Donald Trump does not have the right temperament, the knowledge, or the capability of being president of the United States. I think I'm just stunned, frankly, that it has gotten this far.
How do you think Donald Trump happened? What happened in this country that allowed for this?
I keep asking myself that. I think that clearly there are divisions in this country, and there are those who feel that they have been neglected. And Hillary Clinton has made it a big point to say that she will, in fact, deal with the issues that have created this disparity. But I think that what happened is that there were those that were elected, like the Tea Party, to come to Washington to do nothing, to really block the doing of the system. And there has been a real question about what government does and really seeding distrust in everybody. And I think that it happened because, if I just can put it bluntly, the Republican Party was not able to sort out what it was going to do, and people thought he was a joke for so long and did not think that it was possible. So I am very troubled about how it happened.
Secretary Albright, you are one of the few people that I can ask this question of. There has been so much talk in this election of Russia and Vladimir Putin. I'm looking at a picture right now of a meeting you had with him. Do you worry about him? What kind of person is he? Is he trying to meddle, in your opinion, with this election?
I have met him. I think that we have to remember that he is a KGB agent. He is playing a weak hand because there are very serious problems in Russia with the economy because of the oil prices. And he, whenever something like that happens, you need a scapegoat and an enemy. And he's decided that America is the enemy. And what he wants to do is to divide us from Europe and divide the Europeans from each other. And he also is very skilled at propaganda. And what I am troubled by, in addition to so many things about Trump, is that he's a gift to Putin, because what Putin wants to do is to, as I said, divide Europe. And when Trump makes statements about NATO being dysfunctional and we wouldn't live up to our obligations under it unless people paid, kind of blackmailing our allies, I think that he is doing things that Putin would like to be doing. He's a gift to Putin. And now that we also know that Trump has dealings in Russia, financial ones, Putin is a gift to Trump. And I am very troubled by what the Russians are, the hacking aspect of it, because the intelligence community has indicated that they're behind it. And We cannot let them interfere in our election, which is why I'm very glad that there is really a very active way to get people to the polls, and then also early voting in states, and that people are aware that there need to be those to make sure that this is, as always has been in America, a free and fair election.
In Ohio, no Republican has ever won the presidency without carrying Ohio. It depends on which poll you look at on which day. Donald Trump still is doing fair here. What do you make of that as you've traveled the state this weekend?
I think it is very troubling. I can't understand why this is happening, but I have to tell you this. In reading about what is going on in Ohio, Trump is now attacking the Republican Party of Ohio and really being even more divisive. And I think that who knows what is going to happen, but Ohio is a swing state, which is why I'm here. I'm meeting a lot of people, talking about the importance of this election, and making clear that even as the numbers go up for Hillary, not only in Ohio, but in other swing states, that nobody can take anything for granted, that people have to get out and vote, because what Trump is trying to do now is to suppress the vote by scaring people. And so this is a key state. I am driving through Ohio now, and I do see a Trump sign here and there, and I really wonder what the people that have those signs think he is going to do, because he does not have any plan that makes any sense. And it's just a bunch of slogans and playing off a desire, of some people to find a scapegoat, when in fact we have to find solutions. And Hillary is the one that has the solutions.
That being said, when Hillary Clinton's name is mentioned anywhere, you're one of the only people I can ask this of, the two buzzwords that come up, Benghazi emails, immediately. Two-part question, do you feel she did anything wrong in either one of those positions, and why is Hillary the right person for Ohio and the country?
Well, I think she has said herself that she made a mistake on the emails. She has taken responsibility for that. I think on Benghazi, I don't think she did anything wrong. By the way, if you ask people where Benghazi is, when they just say Benghazi, they say somewhere in the Middle East, meaning that they have not a clue, just because the word Benghazi. I think that Benghazi was a huge tragedy, and many people were involved in making assessments of it, and Chris Evans is somebody that worked for me, and his death and that of the others is a huge tragedy, but it is not anything that Hillary did. And I think that what is important is to understand that in Hillary we have a person who has more experience in national security policy than anybody that has ever run for president. I trust her. I trust her with the security of our people, and I trust her temperament and her ability to understand what a difficult world we live in. And I don't trust Donald Trump, who explodes, who has, gets up at 3 a.m. to do nasty tweets, who disregards individuals. He is not a representative for America. And this is an absolutely crucial election.
Secretary Albright, one quick parting question here. During this campaign, in the beginning, a lot of attention was thrust upon you when you were introducing Clinton at a campaign event in New Hampshire. You said there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. It's a unique election, could be the first woman president. You've certainly made headroads there, being the first woman Secretary of State. Do you regret that at all now, saying that?
No, but I tell you, I've said that statement now forever, and what people didn't hear, because they had started to applaud already, was I looked at Hillary and I said, therefore you are going to the other place because of everything that you have done for women. And I think the very important part about Hillary is that she has, in fact, been an advocate for women's issues for her whole life. She understands that we need equal pay for equal work, that we need to have control over our own bodies, that women When women are economically and politically empowered, societies function better. And when she is elected president, it will be the 100th anniversary of when American women got the vote. We need to get out there and use it, because Hillary Clinton is the best prepared person ever to become president of the United States, and it's just a bonus that she's a woman. And I'm honored to be able to speak on her behalf.
Here at the radio station, we have several connections to Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. As you probably know, Scott, myself, and Terry went to Pittsburgh recently to personally witness the introduction of the Mr. Rogers commemorative stamp. Among the other attendees was Joe Negri, also known as Handyman Negri, although actually he wasn't very handy. He just played that role on the TV show, but he is a very gifted musician. Scott had the pleasure of speaking with Joe Handyman Negri.
He wouldn't do commercials with a cereal that had sugar in it. He wouldn't do toys that were like, you remember G.I. Joe? It was a toy with a gun. He would not do those commercials, and he was always fighting with the sales department. And eventually, you know, they just parted company. And I was on the show as I was musical director over at TAE. So the reason I got on the show was the station put me on there to just kind of work with them, you know, add music and stuff like that. He was very nice, and then as we worked together, he would say to me, "Why don't you walk through the neighborhood?" You know, and I used to feel like Josie Carey on the children's corner, walking through the neighborhood, saying hi to Corny and XDL and all the King Friday and all the puppets. So we actually knew each other long before a good year or so before the current show started. Gee, 1968. Is that February 19th?
1960. Wow. How did you meet Fred Rogers?
Well, I actually met him. I was working at KDKA a little bit before I moved over to WTAE. And I was a good friend of Josie's, Josie Carey. She was quite a good songwriter. And I met Fred through Josie. They were doing the Children's Corner at the time. You know, it was the early days of TV. There weren't that many people on it, and we all got to know one another. So that's how I got to know him first, and then we became closer friends when he came over to TAE to do that 15-minute, you know, predecessor of the neighborhood. And then about a year after he left TAE, I get this phone call from him, and he said, "I'm going to start a new show on public television. How would you like to be our handyman?" Well, that was always a big joke, and I'm sure you've heard it. I'm very unhandy. I'm handy with a guitar, but not with a hammer and nails.
What kind of guy would you describe Fred Rogers? What kind of man was he off the set?
He was very bright, very talented. He was easygoing, you know. He was kind of fun to be with, and he had a good sense of humor. But the one thing about him was that when he wrote a script, well, he wanted it done that way, and he wanted it done perfectly, you know. And so he was quite particular about everything. We went over to the neighborhood segments. They were like 5 to maybe 10 minutes long, and we would go over them and rehearse them, and then maybe tape them at least twice. And if he wasn't happy, we would tape them again, you know. And I remember Johnny Costa. You remember that name, don't you?
I do.
Johnny was a good friend of mine. So when we would tape these neighborhood segments, Johnny would be playing live while the scene was going on. And It was amazing. You know, he was just doing it spontaneously, watching the TV screen. It was almost like an old-time silent movie piano player playing along with the movie action, you know. So Johnny would do that. And if we would retape something like, say, three times, Fred would say, "Okay, let's go with that one." And Johnny would always say, "Sure, he would pick that one. That's the one I didn't play good on."
You know, 32 years the show ran, over 32 years.
Yeah.
Did you ever think of leaving the show? That's a long time.
You know, that's amazing, Scott. No, I don't think any of us ever did. We had people that would come in. I remember we had some performers that came in from Canada. Fred knew a lot of Canadians because he had spent time up in Toronto at the TV station up there. So he would bring people in, but they would just come in and do appearances, you know, like our guests, like Wynton Marsalis or Yo-Yo Ma. They would just do an appearance. But the regulars, gee, I don't think anybody ever wanted to leave. It was good stuff, you know.
There were so many great programs. I was watching one this morning with, I forget her name, but the lady who was the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, did she come on? Yeah, yeah, I'll never forget meeting her. You know, I didn't realize that. Did David tell you yesterday? That was kind of his suggestion. He said to Fred, "We ought to get her on, and because she frightens a lot of children, and maybe, you know, seeing her like this would eliminate that fear that people had." Oh, I remember, even I was an adult, and I was even, you know, in awe of her. She scared me too.
Yeah, she was something else. And then she, for people who don't remember the show, she came on dressed like she was in The Wizard of Oz, but then took the outfit off and sat and talked with Fred.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good. I remember we had Big Bird on. I don't know if Big Bird took his head off, his bird head off. I don't know. I walked around with him, I remember. I was amazed at how he could operate inside that costume. He had the microphone on a pole or something so that he could talk in there, you know.
It was
a lot of good guests, a lot of great guests.
32 years. Did you have a favorite episode?
Well, I had several. I think Wynton was one of my favorites. I really always liked him. And, you know, he's gone on to really gigantic things. He runs the Lincoln Center Orchestra now and everything. He was really a nice guy, and we had his family on, his father, and Branford, the sax guy, and a couple of younger brothers who I understand are both playing now. One was about 13 years old at the time, and he was the drummer, and I understand he's playing today. So Branford was really good, you know, because I was always into jazz, and Branford was one of the best.
We will conclude some of our favorite celebrity interview segments featuring interviewer Scott Spears with the talk he had with legendary game show host Bob Barker when Scott said, "Come on down," to the WWGH microphones. Bob graciously said yes.
You have certainly started my day off well.
Bob, what are your days like in your ninth decade? What do you do?
I am a complete success at retirement. I do just as I wish. I do a lot of work on behalf of animals, as you know. That takes a lot of my time, and it's time not only well spent, but time that I thoroughly enjoy. And beyond that, I read quite a bit, and I still work out. I'm not certainly like I once did, but I try to work out. I think exercise and diet are very important when you're 93 years old.
Thank you for listening to some of the most memorable celebrity interviews from the Scott Spears program on WWGH Radio. This is Adam Lepp.